Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Merle Exit. Well, let's see, it's raining outside here in New York City, but that's okay because I'm indoors. Yeah, I could be outdoors, like maybe on a farm or something, and having to feed all the animals. And that's where I'm going to go today, actually, is the BNY Farms, because we're going to talk about, what it's like to have the animals that you're going to deliciously enjoy at some point. We're going to have Judy is going to talk to us. Her name, she's the owner of BNY Farms, Judy Genova. And we're going to have a chat with her. We have to have a quick commercial, of course. One having nothing to do with the other, but
Hey, Martha, why do you smile? I was just thinking, I'm here at Ronnie Brook Farms eating delicious grass, not being injected with some synthetic hormones. I just gave birth to another cutie calf and don't even have to deal with any bull. I hear you, Mar. You know what they call cows that can't give milk? No, what, Sal? Utter failure. So, where is our big daddy Ronnie? Probably somewhere exercising, doing yogurt. At Ronnie Brook Farms, you'll find the best of dairy products. Our milks vary in butterfat from non-fat to heavy cream. Enjoy the creamy yogurts from the cup or one that you can simply drink with the best of culture without artificial thickeners or additives. We don't have sour cream. We do have creme fraiche. Butter is better when you can choose cinnamon toast to spread on bread or pancakes. And since we scream for ice cream any time of year, you'll love our 16% butterfat. Do you remember getting bottled milk delivered, opening it to find the cream on the top? That is how you'll find our sweet-tasting cream-lined milk. I'll hand it to you, Sal. Our milk may get past your eyes, but certainly not homogenized. Ronnie Brook Farms, where cows always seem to be in a good mood. Check us out at www.ronniebrook.com.
Okay, well, now we're going to go from Ronnie Brook Farms over to the farms that, well, they'll be mooing, but hi, Judy.
Hi there. How are you, Merle?
Okay.
They'll actually be buying. They won't be mooing. They'll be buying.
Oh, okay. Well, tell me, I mean, like, first of all, how did you decide to do this, to have a farm?
Well, I always knew I was going to live in the country, even as a young girl. Like, actually, to be honest, I was born in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, but I just was one of those people that never really looked like I belong in the city. I was one of those kids that had pigtails and freckles and blue eyes, and just always knew from a very young age I was going to somehow wind up being out in the country. And when I was in my 20s, I became very passionate about it. I always worked outside on farms, putting myself through college. I worked on vegetable farms in New Jersey and then had an opportunity to move up to the Finger Lakes region of New York And I helped a friend of mine who had purchased 260 acres with the intention of starting a Christmas tree farm, and I was the person that helped plant the trees. And got a job in an organic vegetable farm, and just one thing led to another being up here, and decided one day I wanted to have a farm of my own, and I spent 2.5 years looking for the right piece of land, and came upon this piece of land that I now reside on, and we built our own place and just started from scratch. I was like one of those homestead moms, you know. I had 2 home births, and my kids didn't even know what sliced bread was till they went to school. I homeschooled them for a bit, and always had 100 chickens, figuring a family of 4 needed 2 chickens a week in the freezer, so did the math on that, and we always had a huge garden and grew everything, and my late husband was a fisherman, fly fisherman, and passed that on to my son, who then went on to become quite an expert marksman and archer, and just got his New York State hunting and fishing guide license. Very proud of that. And figured we were paying lots of taxes for the land, so might as well do something with it. And went from feeding my family to then now feeding 4 to 5 markets through the green markets at New York City, coming down twice a week. And we do Friday at Union Square, and then we do Sunday at Tompkins Square Park in the East Village, and then a few blocks away from there, we do Stuyvesant Town in the Peter Cooper Village, and then we head over to Forest Hill, Queens on Sunday, and we do that market, and then we've been invited to join a new market in Brooklyn on the south end of Prospect Park on Sundays also, called Parkside Market on Parkside Avenue. So that keeps us pretty busy, and then we do the farm when we're not in the city, which is the other 5 days a week.
Wow. I'm just curious. The Parkside Market is now a new green market location?
Correct. We did it briefly last year. It's one of the shorter span markets, meaning it starts a little bit later in the season. I believe this year they're starting it in either, I think it's going to be June through November. And we typically do most of our markets April through right up until Christmas. We need to take January, February, and March off, even though some of the markets do run year-round, because we have lambing season. In fact, I just had my last lamb born midnight on Sunday, in the very wee hours into Monday morning when we got back from the markets in New York City. So that was kind of interesting. And, so we're done with lambing now, and now we pick up the markets full kick for the season.
So how did you get into, like, okay, so at some point so you had chickens, and now, of course, you have more than chickens. You're dealing with, in terms of the products, now there's pigs and cows.
No cows.
No cows.
But we have been known to raise some ducks upon occasion. So what happened was, I was one of these, like I said, homeschooled, homestead moms, and decided, all right, wouldn't it be fun for the kids to have a couple of sheep around? So I went to the New York State Fair, which is held in August of every year up in Syracuse, New York. It's a huge fair, and they have 4-H clubs, and they have people from all over the state who bring in their prized breeds of every conceivable type of livestock, and they have these juried shows. And I just said, I just want to see what's out there in terms of breeds for sheep. I wanted to educate myself, and just visually, I'm a very visual person. I wanted to just see some of these shows and see what's out there for the temperaments of certain breeds and why people gravitate towards some breeds rather than others. And I stumbled upon a woman who was the number one blue ribbon champion every year in a row up at that show for a breed called Tunis, which is short for Tunisia. And I'll get back to the whole story, but basically when I saw these sheep, I totally fell in love. I guess you could say it was love at first sight. I felt that this was my breed. They were very different than the typical sheep that you might have in mind. They were not white. They had a reddish face and green eyes, and their legs were also brownish. Their fleece was a creamier, kind of off-white, more of a buttery color, but there was something about their faces that was just very, very proud and beautiful. And the history of the breed is also interesting in that the story goes they were given as a gift to George Washington by the King of Tunisia back, you know, during the day. And when the ship came into the Philadelphia harbor with the gift of I don't know how many on board, the sheep basically jumped ship, and they went into the countryside into Pennsylvania and started to sort of intermingle as a flock wherever they went. And that was what was the United States version of the original Tunis. And then it goes on that during the Civil War, when the starving soldiers would go looking for food, whenever they saw the tuna sheep, they would pretty much eat them almost to extinction. They were very, very delicious. And what set them apart from other sheep breeds, you know, was that in blind taste tests nowadays, when they put out, you know, at these, you know, very fancy shows where they have like maybe 50 or 60 varieties of different lamb cuts and people are blindfolded, tunis usually comes in the top two or three for flavor. And the reason for that is that there's no gaminess or barnyard flavor to them. You can eat a pot of chili made with a 5 to 8 year old tunis, and you wouldn't know the difference from a lamb that was, you know, 8 months old. So they make an incredible mutton. You know, during the Second World War, a lot of our soldiers had to eat canned mutton as rations, and they will never go back to eating lamb again. Lamb to them is a four-letter word. But when you give them mutton from a really nice pasture-raised tunis, they just think it's absolutely delicious. So we do a fair bit of mutton selling on our table, and people really go crazy for it as well. So that was another thing that drew me to the tunis, was that the taste really holds up. And you're able to, you know, extend your marketability of the meat by being able to sell an older animal, you know, versus just putting it into, you know, ground or dog food kind of thing. So they're a very gentle breed. They make very excellent mothers. And their wool is really fantastic. If people come to my Union Square Market on Fridays, that's where I bring sort of the mother load of all my different wool, my yarn colors. And we do organically certified dyed yarns from our tunis, and people just really love it. And we get a lot of tourists that come to the stand from a lot of the Scandinavian countries, which are, you know, known for being knitting cultures. And people take away a lot of my yarn as souvenirs of their trip to New York City. And so that's kind of a cool thing too about the tunis. They're a multi-purpose, and I just like being around them. They're just fantastic to hang out with.
Well, when you say now, so mutton is simply just an older lamb, is that?
Well, I'll be very specific. When we send a lamb or any sheep to be butchered, because we're doing resale and because we're going through the green market, the law there is that to resale meat, as opposed to just somebody that grows something and then wants to have it butchered for their own family consumption,
right.
It has to be USDA, all right? That would be the difference between taking your meat to a USDA butcher versus what's called a custom butcher. And when you go to a USDA butcher, there has to be a USDA inspector on site whenever anything, not just a sheep, but any animal is butchered on the killing floor of that USDA plant. And the first thing that the USDA inspector is going to do when he inspects your sheep carcass is he opens the mouth and he has to check the glands and he has to make sure everything looks healthy there. And when he looks in the back of the jaw, he looks at the teeth to determine the age of the animal. And what makes the legal distinction from a lamb to a sheep or a mutton is when the second year molars at the back of the mouth erupt. And just like we have baby teeth and then our baby teeth fall out and we get our adult teeth, same for sheep. And when the inspector looks in the mouth, if he does not see the second year molars have erupted, then he can stamp that animal as a lamb. And then on all of my packaging, whether it be a lamb chop or a ground lamb, it will say lamb. The butcher will, you know, word it accordingly. But if he sees the second year molars have erupted, and sometimes that can be even older than 2 years old. It just depends on the animal. He has to then, by law, call that a mutton. And therefore, when you come to my stand, it'll say either mutton chop or ground mutton, mutton shank, so on and so forth. And what I like to tell people who are a little maybe scared of trying the mutton is, have you ever gone to a steakhouse? And have you ever had a piece of veal versus a piece of dry-aged meat? And you'll know that both are delicious, but they have a very different taste profile, whereas veal is usually pinker and maybe a little lighter in texture or taste, whereas good dry-aged beef is going to be just darker and very full, and maybe a little bit more minerally tasting, a richer taste. That's the same for mutton. The other difference would be if you're looking to quickly pan-sear a lamb chop, that'll take maybe 2.5 minutes on each side, and you've got dinner in under 10 minutes, you would go with a lamb chop. But for mutton, I prefer to have the butcher cut those cuts into things that you would low and slow cook. For example, a nice shoulder roast or a leg of lamb or a shank, something that you could braise or stew or bake. Whereas I do eat, you know, mutton, you know, chops. I have the butcher slice them very, very thin so that they sear instantly. But they can be a little chewier. And some people prefer it. A lot of my customers just want mutton because they just want that deeper flavor. And never has anyone said, oh, this really tastes like gamey, or, you know, I can smell the barn floor in this, which that
right.
can be a problem with certain animals that aren't raised quite correctly. So that's another plug for reintroducing mutton back onto the lamb gourmet table.
If you had gotten a ground lamb, is there a possibility, I don't mean from you, but is there a possibility that somebody might be actually getting ground mutton?
I can't speak for everybody's butcher. It just depends if you've got a butcher that goes by the code or not. Our butcher is a multi-million dollar brand new USDA plant, and it is so spick and span and clean and so uber by the book because they're new and they want to do everything right. And so I can tell you with 100% assuredly that when you're buying my mutton, it's 100%
right.
mutton. And when you're buying my ground lamb, never shall the twain mix. But I don't know what other people's butchers are doing. I just can't speak for that.
Okay. No, of course, I'm curious as, you know, what that people, I mean, like, for instance, and I guess that I don't think it really matters when you're dealing with your cat or your dog. I mean, if it says lamb, it could be mutton.
It depends. I know a couple of pet foods have gotten into some trouble with misadvertising and using, you know, rancid putrefied meat when they're telling everybody, oh, it's the wild game and it's no grain and eat in the wild. But really, it's really just, you know, things that are going to the rendering plant that the company's buying real cheap. So I can't, again, that's not what I'm here to talk about. I don't know.
Okay. No, I just know my
practice and what I'm trying to represent what I know and what I believe to be, you know, how we want to raise our animals and how we want them marketed and butchered and all that.
Okay. So then other than going to the green markets, there's no other opportunity. I mean, there's not, people don't come up to your farm and say, hey, you want to get such and such, or?
Well, what I do is for my local folks here, I have a walk-in cooler, and I do what I call the Monday afternoon special. So whatever comes back from New York City Sunday night, everything is kept on ice, and then it goes immediately into my walk-in, which is chilled very, very, you know, very cool. And then people can come over, and I give them the upstate Finger Lake price, let's just say that, because these are local people that don't have the income and we're a different demographic than many of the
right.
New York City folks. So then I can give a little price break. Maybe some of the packages have a little torn label from just the handling over the weekend, but everything still has, you know, it's within expiration date code. And then whatever doesn't sell after that, I work at a high school for my other job 4 days a week, so I'll bring in a insulated bag maybe on Tuesday with some other stuff, and then I've got my, you know, my teachers that love my stuff and will just take it off my hands for a good deal. And then the rest of it we freeze, and we either eat it ourselves or we will do freezer bag specials towards the end of the season when I'm trying to clear out the freezer. And I have a lot of my customers that want to just, they don't care. They just want whatever I have they want for the 3 months that I don't come down, because they only want to eat my meat. In fact, they'll beg me sometimes to ship it in the mail, which I have done. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So, okay. So now, does it make it, like, you have, like, I've seen that you have a certain type of pigs. Does that make any difference?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, a lot of people, when they think of pigs, they think of the pink pigs or the whiter pigs.
Yeah.
I try to tend to shy away from that color and that breed. I like a darker pig. I know that in Europe, Austria being one of the largest pig-rearing cultures in the world, I did a lot of research on pig breeds, and they truly believe that the best-tasting pig or pork in the world is something that comes from a dark brown or a black pig only. It can't be white. The white pigs are sort of the genetically modified ones that are very fast-growing. They're very easy to skin from the butcher side of it. They're very uniform, easy to cut. But in terms of flavor profile and in terms of lard and things that people are looking for who really are aficionados of what you can do with pork, they don't want the pinkies. We call them the pinkies. So
mm-hmm.
I raise a bunch of different breeds that are all heirloom, and those are the ones that I prefer. I keep them outside 24/7. I keep them outside 12 months out of the year. They're in snow. They sleep in all kinds of elements, and then they have the option to come into a three-sided Quonset hut, but they prefer to be outside. They sleep in a spiral circle with the biggest ones on the bottom and the smaller ones on top, which is really beautiful to see how they kind of maneuver every night in their sleeping position, and then the water sheds off them, which is pretty amazing. And they're happy pigs, and they're never sick, and they're not wormy, and they're delicious. People tell me that my not only my bacon, but simple cuts, including just my raw pig belly and my pork chops, they say they've never eaten meat that tastes like this. And I have a pretty loyal clientele, that's what I'm going to say.
So, in other words, I would like, this is what I personally find in terms of pork. I'm okay, like, eating, like, bacon, but there's times that, let's say I have a pork chop and it's like, I can't, if I want to use the word gamey, that's a, you know, there's a
mm-hmm,
taste
mm-hmm.
that I don't prefer, and it's like,
right.
well, you know, and I'm
right.
not sure, like.
It might be tough. It might be a tougher, older pig that you're eating from. All of my pigs are under 10 months old, and the meat is very, very tender. And that's just how we do it. We don't put down, like, a pig can get to 1,500 pounds, you know, if you let it. And we don't do that. Our pigs, typically, when they get onto the butcher floor, are anywhere from 250 to 275 pounds live weight. And they're just juicy and very moist and tender and just the right amount of marbling.
So can you get, like, all kinds of cuts?
Everything that you could ever want from a pig, we do. We sell everything from the oink to the tail, including the tail. We do sell pig tail every week. We sell the trotters, which are the feet. We sell the ears. We sell the skin. We sell some of the fat. We sell every imaginable cut, you know, the hocks, the shoulder, the hams, the belly, the ground pork, fresh ground pork for people that like to make shumai and all the Asian dishes, the ribs, the jowl bacon. We're very known for our jowl. It's called guanciale. It's an Italian specialty. It comes from the cheek. And no matter how big the pig is, the jowl isn't ever going to be bigger than maybe 6 pounds on each side. So the bacon that you get from smoking the jowl and then slicing it is unbelievably delicious. It's very soft and creamy, and it's a specialty because it's limited. Most pigs, in terms of, you know, the bacon, what people know as the slab bacon or the belly bacon, you know, the most you're going to get is about 20 or 25 pounds out of a pig. But a jowl, you're only going to get maybe, you know, 6 to 8 pounds once it cures and shrinks and smokes. So it's a real rare delicacy, and we try to sell it every week. So we've been known to sell pig heads, scalded for people that want to do all kinds of things, make head cheese. We try to use every possible piece of that pig.
Wow.
Yeah.
And getting
including the sheep too. We use everything on the sheep. We we have our butcher skin the fleece, which is the hide, and then he salts it for us with kosher salt. and then we pick that up as soon as he gets a certain quantity, and then we ship it to our tannery in Pennsylvania. We use a beautiful tannery. It takes about 2 months to get those tanned and brought back to us, and then starting in October for the holiday season, if you come to our markets, primarily Union Square and also Forest Hill, we display beautiful, beautiful professionally tanned fleeces that have a beautiful sheep leather backing, and they're the real deal. These are not the ones that you get at Costco for $25. These are, you know, beautiful. They'll last you a lifetime. Very high quality. And at my Forest Hill market especially, there's a very large Russian and Bahrainian population, and these people were furriers. They know all about that.
Oh.
And when they come to my stand, they start going off in Uzbekistan and Russian, all the words that mean very beautiful, very high quality. And these are people that you could tell worked with their hands their whole life. They know how to make coats. They know how to make suede. And I'm very proud of our fleeces. So on the sheep, we use the hide. We sell all the bones. We're very big into educating people how to make bone broth and stock. We also use the organ meats. We're very, very, very advocates of teaching, especially couples that are trying to have babies or women that are pregnant or just had babies, how to incorporate fresh organ meat into their diet to keep their energy and to recover, and how to promote sneaking organ meats into little kids' food so that kids are getting just the nutrient denseness of a piece of liver or a fresh kidney without knowing it. And I used to be a natural foods cooking teacher, so I'm very good at disguising foods and making them palatable for things that people might normally think of, well, that, you know, that's just dog food. Whereas in other cultures, you know, most ethnic groups around the world treasure organ meats, but in our culture, you know, the butcher saves those and sells them for the dog food. So we sort of have it backwards here. So we try to promote all of that old world cooking.
Do you sell anything that's already, like, cooked and frozen? Do you do anything like that?
No,
oh, okay.
I do not. I also forgot to mention we sell pasture-raised eggs. And the cool thing about our eggs is that our flock is also outside, and they roost in the trees, and then they come down and they lay every day. And they follow my sheep, and follow is sort of a euphemism for they clean up after them. I won't go into detail. So
okay.
I don't have to give them very much feed at all. So a lot of people are always very concerned what's in the feed. Is there soy product in the feed? My child's very allergic to corn. I don't want to have it pass through the feed. And I'm like, look, I have to give a base feed just to make sure they have enough energy and feathers and bone structure. But for the reality of it, if I'm feeding, you know, a couple hundred chickens a bucket of feed, a small bucket, a pail, like a small pail, that's a lot in a day. They're mostly going and feeding after the sheep, and they're going on grass and worms and bugs. And our yolks are really deep and very flavorful. People tell me they just wait all winter for my eggs to come back on the stand, and they say there's no comparison, and I feel good about that. So very happy with that.
Then also let me ask you about, okay, Cornish and...
Yes, okay, that's a big, yes. That's a good question. I'm glad you asked that. We raise several breeds. A breed is the like when you look at a dog, all right, and you see a poodle, that's the breed name versus, let's say, a schnauzer. That's also a breed. So
right.
Cornish is the breed. And in farming, a lot of the breeds were named for the region that they come from. And a lot of chickens are really tropical in nature, but they did come on ships. And England was a very big, big poultry producing country, and a lot of the breeds that we know now were named after the areas in England. So a Cornish was named after the Cornish area. There's Suffolk. There's, you know, all kinds of names that tend to come from those areas. And the Cornish hens that people are used to, like at a banquet where you get a petite little bird on your plate, that's the same breed as what I raise. It's just that those are slaughtered at 3 weeks old, usually 3 to 4 weeks old. And typically in commercial practice, those Cornish little birds don't ever go outside. They're raised in big, big greenhouses or hoop houses where they are fed and watered under a cover. They could be called free range because technically they're running around, but they're not running around outside. So people have to be very careful when you see somebody telling you they're raising free range or free running chickens or eggs. Ask them, well, are they outside or are they undercover? That's a big question you want to ask. And so we don't raise the little ones because I tried, and to me, they're flavorless, and I don't believe it's the way I want to farm. I don't want to raise something that's never been outside and had a chance to be a chicken. I think part of being a chicken is knowing how to hunt and peck and go after the food. A chicken will go, you know, half a mile down the road if it finds a green that it needs, and that green might be intuitively what it might need to make its shell stronger. But when you start quarantining animals, and even people that raise flocks on grass, but they move them around in a pen every day, those chickens don't ever have the chance to intuitively go and find what they need. And I let my chickens, after having many experimentations with doing all of the things that all the, you know, the new agey ideas about how to pasture raise everything, for me, the most safest and the healthiest for my flock is to let them be chickens. I let them out. I let them roost in the trees. I let them hunt and peck wherever they want to go to find whatever they need. They always know they can come back and have some, you know, grain if they need it. But for the most part, those chickens, I hardly see them until they start, you know, the sun starts to set and they come back. And I have far less losses that way than quarantining them and moving them around on grass every 2 days. When I have quarantined them that way on pasture, the coyotes, the raccoons, the mink, the skunks, they all know where to find them, and they will find them, and they will get in. And now, to me, it's very inhumane because you're basically, you know, leading the predator to the slaughter. You're giving them, you know, you might as well put a big arrow with a neon sign, come have dinner now, okay? And this way, the chickens can defend themselves. I keep a bunch of roosters, and the roosters are unbelievable, you know, vanguards to their flock. I mean, even if I take a chicken and move her around, the rooster comes right up to me like, hey, what are you doing with my girl, you know? And I also have a sheep guard dog that never comes in. He's always with the sheep, and he always protects the chickens, too. So I can't tell you. I don't know the last time I found a dead chicken, to be honest. And I think I'm doing pretty good that way.
And, of course, I'm sure everybody's asked, have any of them ever crossed the street?
100%. Of course, that's how you get the joke.
Chickens cross the street.
Only here we don't call them streets. We call them roads, okay?
Oh,
like
okay.
The real, it's why did the chicken cross the road?
Yeah. Oh, okay. So
anything else?
this is so how many years have you been doing this in terms of with the farm, this particular farm?
I've been on my farm since, let's see, I'm going to say 1988, and we built our own house. We put the road in. There was nothing here, and we just made it what it is. We made it the home. And then I seriously decided to reinvent the farm probably about 10 years ago, and I took a little money, and I reinvested in the barn that was sagging, and I made a beautiful, beautiful barn and designed how I wanted it inside and put fencing up to protect the sheep. And just got a little more serious and then decided to try one market. And my very first market was probably, I think, 7 years ago, and that was the Stuyvesant Town Market in the Peter Cooper Village on 14th and Avenue A in the Peter Cooper Square. It's a park in the East Village. And that was an amazing first market. The demographics of that housing development were fantastic, and people were so, so supportive of us. And then they got, I think the demographic switched a few years ago, especially after the hurricane. A lot of the families got really scared after that devastation down there. And a lot of the families, especially with younger children, moved out. And so the neighborhood started to sort of dramatically change. And I noticed fewer and far between were families buying meat for the week, which was great for us. And it became more college kids that were crammed into the apartments now. And they still appreciate that the farmers market's there, and we still have a loyal, loyal clientele. But that market has not been as productive as it originally was. So I started Tompkins Square, figuring they were only four blocks away. Very different demographic, much more of an artist community, and again, more of the NYU community. But still, families are moving in. It's gentrifying a bit, and people really have been very appreciative. There are, you know, we have our regular residents who come every week. And then we were, based on our performance, we were invited to join a brand new market 3 years ago, which was in Forest Hill, Queens, right by the Forest Hill Post Office on Ocean Boulevard, I believe it's called. And that was...
Queens Boulevard.
You're right. Queens Boulevard. Yes. I'm sorry. And on the south side, okay, right by Austin Street. I'm just giving people landmarks here if they're listening. And we're there Sunday. And that, by far, is our busiest market. The folks there had petitioned their town, you know, council people for over 2 years to allow a farmer's market to come in. And it, through a lot of politicking and a lot of pushing, the community finally got what it wanted, and the green market was allowed to come in. This will be the beginning of my third year there. And I'll tell you, that is a fantastic, phenomenal – actually, more than 3 years ago. I'm sorry, I can't remember, but I can't remember how many, maybe going on 4 or 5 years. And that we were welcomed with open arms into a very, very lovely community of very mixed ethnic demographics. And just basically people are starting to buy my meat before I even put my tent up. That's how supportive they are every Sunday when we pull up. And we start selling there at 8 in the morning, and there are times, Merle, where we are completely sold out by 11 in the morning, and that market goes till 3 in the afternoon. So if anybody's listening, I encourage people to get there early. That's when you'll have the pick of everything. I should also mention that some markets we're not allowed to sell the full array of what we bring. So, for example, at Union Square on Friday, we can only sell our lamb, our eggs, our chicken, our yarn, and our fleeces. We're not allowed to sell our pork. And we do what's called a value-added product, which every vendor is allowed to bring 2 to 3 things that you do not raise yourself but are carefully vetted and follow all of the criteria that you as a farmer would do had you wanted to raise it yourself and the green market rules. And so we bring in bison, and we bring in grass-fed red Angus beef that's 100% pasture-raised, and we bring in field-raised rabbit. We don't always have the rabbit, but we do have the beef every week. And so Forest Hills allows us to sell all of that, and we're allowed to sell all of that at Tompkins and at Stye. And at the Parkside Market for right now, we're only allowed to sell our pork and our rabbit and our lamb, our chickens and our eggs. We're not allowed to sell beef there. And so I just want to mention that to folks. But at Forest Hill, you can get everything if you're out that way. And then after our performance at Forest Hill proved that we were steady and reliable and had a good product, we were invited into Union Square. And Union Square, we like to call that the mothership of the green markets. And that's been a great experience for us. We love the exposure there, and that part of Manhattan is just such a vital area, and we get to, you know, I'm being a country girl, I get to see famous people like Bobby Flay and Mark Ruffalo. I'm just not name dropping. Lady Gaga came by to our stand downtown in our East Village market. You know, just those things really are fun for us because, you know, where we live, we don't get to see that too often on the farm. So that's been great.
Well, I think the one in Union Square has been the most well known. I think it has gotten a much more publicity than any of the others. That's where.
Yes, and it is by invitation only. So to be invited into Union Square is a real feather in the cap of a farmer because you have to prove yourself and you have to have something that's interesting. And I believe that we did prove ourselves beforehand, and I do believe that what makes us different, and I want to really stress this to the listening audience, is that we first of all raise the Tunisian lamb, which is very different in taste, being sweeter and very tender, and also we bring fresh. We've spoiled our customers rotten. A lot of vendors will bring frozen and they let it slowly defrost during the day. So if you're coming in at the end of the day from work and you see a piece of meat, you may not really know from another vendor that it had been previously frozen, and that's always a good question to ask. But for us, when, you know, there are times when we can't, let's say in the very hot of summer, we don't want to risk, you know, it being too warm, so we'll freeze something. But for most part, I would say 96% of the markets, everything is fresh butchered every week. So when you come in on a Friday to Union Square, that lamb was cut and wrapped on Thursday the day before.
Wow.
And, so that people really appreciate the fresh chicken. And what's nice about that is, you know, New Yorkers are, I'm learning this, New Yorkers are very impulsive, and not everybody has a lot of time to stand there and defrost something, and when they come out of work, if they can come by my stand at 5 o'clock on a Friday before heading out on the train, and they can pick up a chicken or a half chicken or a couple of lamb chops for their barbecue for the weekend, or they're going away and they want to just grab and go, it's nice to come to my stand and you can grab all of your meat choices and it's fresh. And you have that option. And then if you want to freeze it, that's up to you. But if you know that you're having a dinner party Saturday night, you can pick up a leg of lamb, and you don't have to worry about defrosting it. You can just pick it up for me. My son is on board. He works with me. And all of the crew that I have are very versed. I call us, you know, closet foodies and cooking teachers, some of us. And we can talk you through it. We try to always break down barriers of why you're preventing yourself mentally from picking up that piece of meat and putting it in your shopping bag and taking it home. And sometimes it's just virtually people are ashamed to say, you know what, my whole life I've gone to the supermarket and I've bought a chicken breast, and I really don't know how to cook a half a chicken with the bone on it. And that's where you ask us for help, and we'll guide you through it. My website has a recipe page. You can scroll down and find, you know, a lot of really beautiful recipes with some photos, anything from how to cook braised lamb shanks, how to cook a B&Y bird, you know, how to cook a pork chop. And I think it helps people kind of bridge the gap from going from a place of fear or indecision to feeling, you know what, I've got this. I'm going to do this, and it's going to be delicious. And people come back to me all the time the following week. I followed everything you told me. It was unbelievable. Thank you so much. I want to buy three more now. And that makes me feel really, you know, really good.
That's really great. And by the way, after the show ends, which is going to end soon, I'm going to call you. Now, the phone number, I'm not going to say the phone number, but I see a phone number. Should I call you back on that?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
But let me just plug and tell people that they can reach me at www.byfarms.com. Okay, and I always reply. And if you come and introduce yourself to me at the stand, I keep what I call my shout-out list for each market. So let's say you come to Union Square, introduce yourself, and I'll put you on my list if you want it. It'll be blind copy every week, and you'll get a shout-out, you know, 12 to 24 hours before that next market, letting you know what we're bringing down. Sometimes I'll include a picture if there's a lamb or something cute. I try to keep my download really connected to the farm, because I feel you're not just buying the product, you're buying the farm. I want you to feel, you know, part of the farm, and I want you to feel part of us. And I have very, very loyal, devoted customers for years. They'll, you know, send me information about themselves. They'll send me a little letter during the winter. They just want to stay connected, and that's really why you go to a farmer's market in the first place, for the human touch, and which is quickly disappearing, I think, from all phases of life. And you know, that's why you shop at us, because let's say you're having a hard week. Let's say your husband or somebody just lost a job, and, you know, people have to eat, and we understand that, so nobody goes away hungry. If you tell me, look, I had a rough week, I really would like to buy something, you have something maybe on the smaller side, well, we'll work with you for that. We don't send anybody away hungry if you really want to eat something. So I just put that out there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to, well, I'll be coming back there, because when I do the article, actually, I'm going to do an article that features you.
Oh, great. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. Of course, there's going to be too much to write if I add a bunch of others.
Okay.
But I just quickly just wanted to ask you just one more thing. Of what I saw, that was the first time I've been to that farmer's market. Are there usually more?
Yes. As the season gets warmer and things are available, for example, right now it's too cold for tomatoes, it's too cold for corn on the cob, you know, things are not yet, you know, grown. So as you get into, I'm going to say mid to late May, early June is when the market really starts to have the full range of all of the different vendors. And it gets even better as the summer comes and just more crops come in. And it's not, you know, Forest Hill is not a huge market, but it's a nicely balanced market. And it really hops. And it's a lovely market on Sunday. I'd encourage anybody in the Queens area from Eastern Long Island, people come in to really visit that market. And of course, if you're in the East Village or even Midtown, come down and visit us on Sunday at either of our Tompkins is going on now, and Stuytown starts May 15th until right before it goes until the Sunday before Thanksgiving. And like I said, at Union Square and at Forest Hill, Forest Hill is a year-round market, and we go from April until right before Christmas. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Well, you'll see me. They'll be back there in a couple of weeks to take some photos, et cetera.
We'll send you home with a goodie bag.
Okay. All right. I'll talk to you later, and have a great. You could say goodbye to my audience.
Yes, thank you, everybody, and I hope to meet you in person, and it's been lovely telling you a little bit about my life here.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
All righty, I'm going to hang up now then.
Okay. Bye, Judy.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so I'm going to end this show now. I'll be going back.